Inauguration Day 2013 at the west front of the United States Capitol. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Audie Cornish. Hundreds of thousands are filling into the National Mall to witness President Obama's inauguration speech. People like Patrice Walker, an African-American woman from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And Patrice is here with her six-year-old nephew. And there's many, many families here.
See, oh, absolutely. It's wonderful to look out over this scene. We're on a set of risers and near the west front of the Capitol. Where the president speaks is maybe a little more than 100 feet from us, 100, 125 feet away. And we have this vista off to our right of thousands of people. Many dignitaries have begun to arrive. Many of the dignitary seats have yet to fill up. But there are wonderful little details that you notice in the crowd. Just a couple of moments ago, there were a couple of girls, probably under 10 years old, and they managed to creep up to the U.S. Marine Band, which we're about to hear in the background here. And they've got their hats, they've got their scarves, and they're snapping photographs. It's an exciting moment for them. You see people like that, and you also see some people we mentioned earlier in our coverage, Tuskegee Airmen, who people in wheelchairs, they're veterans of World War II and or their widows, coming to this ceremony. Lots of people for whom this is a significant, significant day.
And you mentioned the Tuskegee Airmen. That's a group that's actually been witness to President Obama's speeches before. We saw them at the Democratic National Convention in North Carolina. It's funny you mentioned the kids taking pictures, because up in the VIP section at the podium, you also see VIPs or perhaps their relatives or friends or staffers doing the same thing, taking pictures of themselves with their phones, only, you know, standing right by where the president will be in just a few hours.
Let me just mention that NPR's Ari Shapiro is joining us today, and he is here with us on the west front of the Capitol. And Ari, I'd just like to ask you, I mean, you're a political reporter, you cover these guys, it's easy to get cynical about them, and of course you have to keep your distance from the partisanship, but at the same time, do you get a little excited at a big moment like this?
Yeah, this is a day when the city comes to life, the country comes to life, people convene in Washington from all over to be part of this and to bear witness to it. It's a huge moment in our nation's history. It is a slightly different moment from the transition of power that we saw 4 years ago. That is this unbelievable logistical enterprise where, in the span of time that the president is delivering his speech and this is going on, they're moving one family out of the White House and moving another family in. Today, a lot of the White House staff is there in their offices working. Yesterday, distant relatives of the first family were being given White House tours. That's something that 4 years ago they wouldn't have been able to do because the previous president was still occupying the White House at that point.
Absolutely. There will be people who will continue. Although this raises another interesting point, Ari Shapiro. One of the challenges of a second term for many a president is personnel. You had your first string people in the first term. You had the best people that you wanted in the first term. Many of them have become burned out. They become tired. They move on to other positions, other jobs, and there's a great challenge now to reorganize.
And we see that even as many of President Obama's closest allies, take Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner, for example, are leaving, he is still trying to stay in this insular circle, nominating, for example, Jack Lew to replace him, formerly the president's chief of staff, now to be the next Treasury Secretary, nominating John Brennan to be the CIA director, another person of this inner circle. It's true that the first tier is leaving, but President Obama is not reaching far outside of his comfort zone to find people to replace them.
Is it fair to say that even though we are going to see the president at this very public event, he must be the most famous man in the world, and he speaks so often, he appears on camera so often, this is still in many ways a private man who relies on a very small circle of advisors.
That's right. When you know, on the weekends, if he goes golfing or plays basketball, we'll get a readout of the people that he's with. And it's the same person time after time after time. Many of the people that he spends time with in his social hours, his off hours when he's vacationing on Martha's Vineyard in August or in Hawaii in December, are people that he was friends with back in Chicago before he became a senator.
Okay, and Ari Shapiro will be with us throughout this morning.
And we're going to head next out onto the National Mall to speak with NPR's Jeff Brady. Hey there, Jeff.
Hey, Adi.
So can you tell us what you're seeing right now?
Well, you know, it's starting to fill up back here. We're about halfway between the Capitol building and the Washington Monument, so quite a ways back. We can just barely see the front of the Capitol from back here. And earlier this morning, not a lot of people back here. Everybody was trying to move as close as possible to that end of the Capitol. But now it's starting to fill up back here, and there is a lot of excitement.
And what are you hearing from people in terms of what they want from President Obama in a second term? We were just talking with Ari about a cabinet and the sort of the things that President Obama wants or needs to do. But what are you actually hearing from voters out there?
You know, one thing that surprised me this morning, just the first six people I talked to, four of them mentioned the Second Amendment and gun violence. And not just one side of the issue there. I talked to a young woman who was from Ohio. She's a high school student who's here to witness the inauguration. And she said, you know, guns are important to us in Ohio. I talked to a lot of people this morning. One man, John Bennett, he traveled here from Fort Valley, Georgia. That's about 100 miles south of Atlanta. He's 71 years old, a retired military veteran, and he says he came here today to witness history.
In my lifetime, at my age, I'll probably never see this again. And it's just a thrill. I'm just overjoyed.
When you say never see this again, what do you mean?
In my lifetime, I'll probably never see a black president in my lifetime, because at my age, I'll probably never see another, and I might be wrong.
He was very excited to be here, drove all the way up from Atlanta there, and dressed very warmly because it is still cold. Not quite as cold as we thought it was going to be today,
and, Jeff,
and certainly not snowflakes.
Wait, it's interesting hearing him say, not in my lifetime, because 4 years ago we heard black voters say, not in my lifetime will we see a black president. Now that they've had one, it's not in my lifetime am I going to see one doing a second term. I mean, the sense of kind of disbelief, I guess, is still pervasive in some circles.
Yep, I ran across a lot of people who weren't able to be here for the first inauguration, but they definitely didn't want to miss the second one, and Mr. Bennett was among those.
Which is a fair point to make, I think. Regardless of politics, I think there were some people who were dubious that America was ready to elect a black president, and there were even people who were dubious that America was ready to do it twice. That has been demonstrated, for better or worse, today, and that certainly seems to be on the minds of people like Mr. Bennett, who you spoke with in the crowd.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we didn't really hear a huge amount about that issue during the campaign, but it's something that's on the mind of a lot of people who are showing up here at the second inauguration today.
That's NPR's Jeff Brady out on the Mall. We're going to turn next to David Wellna, our Capitol correspondent. And, David, can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Audie.
Well, it's interesting. 4 years ago in his inaugural address, President Obama was saying that, you know, we come to proclaim an end to the petty grievances and false promises, talking about politics on the Hill. But it seems like maybe that's not a proclamation that's going to bear out.
Indeed. If he only knew 4 years and one day ago what was in store for him, he was somebody who was coming from Capitol Hill at the time, and he knew certainly the Senate side of Congress fairly well. But I think that the kinds of battles that he quickly ran into, trying to get his stimulus package through, later trying to get through the Supreme Court nominees, and of course his health care bill and the huge battle that ensued with that, I think that this is a president we're going to hear today who may not come at so much as a conciliator as more a battle-hardened gladiator. He is coming to a capital that he has not visited that many times during his first 4 years in office, and there have been complaints that he has not built the kinds of ties with members of Congress that are needed to make the kinds of deals to keep things moving forward. He has battles ahead, and I think his coming here today is a kind of a ceasefire. There are Republican lawmakers on hand here as well as Democratic ones. But I think that once the ceremonies get wrapped up today, it's going to be back to the battleground here that is the U.S. Congress.
Well, let's talk about that, David Wellna, even though we're about to hear more from the Marine Band. It's a festive occasion. The sousaphones are out, as Audie noticed, along with the trumpets and French horns, and they'll be playing again momentarily. But talk us through the next few weeks. Aren't there some major deadlines coming up right in the next few weeks that the President and Congress will battle over?
There are indeed, not to mention the fact that gun legislation is expected very soon here on the Hill, which is going to be a battle in itself. But beyond that, the middle of February is when the money at the Treasury is going to start running out for meeting all of its obligations. And by then, Congress will have to have done something to raise the debt ceiling somewhat. Republicans meeting in Williamsburg, Virginia, House Republicans, said that they're willing to raise the debt ceiling through mid-April, but they want the Senate to pass a budget as a condition for doing so. They say that they're going to withhold the salaries of lawmakers until that happens. Let's see what the Senate does about that. But then after that mid-February deadline for the debt ceiling comes another sort of crisis point, which is the beginning of March when the sequester, the more than $100 billion in automatic cross-board spending cuts comes into effect. Republicans think that's a point where they can get concessions from President Obama. And then late in March, the funding for the federal government runs out. A stopgap resolution expires then. There could be a government shutdown if they don't agree on funding for the rest of the year. So in just the next couple of months, quite a few sort of shock points in store here.
Okay, thanks very much. That's NPR's David Wellna. And let's pick up that very point with NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving, who joins us next as we continue to watch the Marine Band here on the west front of the Capitol. And Ron, I'd like to ask about the situation the president finds himself in. I'm thinking about President George W. Bush in 2005. He had just won. It was a solid victory. He said he had political capital. He was going to spend it, if I'm paraphrasing him properly. And he wanted to change Social Security. He had an agenda he was going to push. In the end, that agenda fell apart. But he was seen as the man who had the whip hand. You have a president here who has a series of crises or seeming crises to deal with right away. Is this unusual?
It's unusual for a president to have quite so many things that are immediately facing him of a domestic nature, all of those fiscal issues that David Wellna just enumerated. Plus, he wants to move on guns. Plus, he wants to move immediately on immigration. Plus, he wants to move very quickly on climate change. And, of course, he has the usual array of foreign threats before him. We have just had a horrible incident in Algeria. More than 80 dead in a hostage taking. Apparently, Al-Qaeda was responsible, claiming credit for that. The president can always find himself in an international crisis. So to go back to your comparison of George W. Bush in 2005, he was knee-deep, at least, in the Iraq war at that time. We were still in Afghanistan. And yet he wanted to use his political capital to move on an issue like Social Security. That didn't happen largely because his own party didn't get behind it.
And we'll see how the party alliances shape up this time around. Once we get through the inauguration today, which we'll be covering live, a little bit more than an hour, hour and a half, the president will formally take the oath of office. And we will continue throughout the morning with special coverage here on NPR News. This is special coverage of Inauguration Day 2013. I'm Steve Inske.
And I'm Audie Cornish. We're here on the west front of the Capitol building as the president's public swearing-in draws near.
This is always a massive operation. Many of the main arteries through Washington are shut down for security. You see military Humvees and military uniforms on the street as well as police officers. And the National Mall is nevertheless filling with people filtering through that security.
Not quite as many visitors as 4 years ago. Still, the crowd is expected to surpass 500,000 this time. And a select few, of course, have made it to the VIP seats. For more on that, we're joined by NPR's David Wellna. David?
Yes, Audia.
And so, I don't know from your vantage point what VIPs you see headed this way.
I'm up in the... It's not quite the nosebleed section, but it's the highest seating area surrounding the podium where President Obama will be speaking not long from now. The people who are sitting here are generally either connected to people in the government, or they are big contributors to the Obama campaign and to his inauguration.
And I also want to bring NPR's Ari Shapiro, who's actually seated right next to me.
Hi,
in the risers, looking pretty warm. Tell us a little bit about what happened over the weekend, what kind of events President Obama was doing.
As many people know, this is going to be the second time this weekend that he'll take the inaugural oath. The Constitution mandates that the new term begin on January 20th, which of course was yesterday. And so first thing in the morning, Vice President Biden was sworn in by Justice Sonia Sotomayor. It happened first thing in the morning because she had a book signing in New York and refused to reschedule it for the vice president.
Okay.
So when he asked her to sign him, to swear him in, she said, sure, but it'll have to be right at the first thing in the morning because I got to catch a train in New York. A little later in the morning, Chief Justice John Roberts swore in President Obama in the blue room of the White House. His family was there. It took less than 2 minutes altogether. They also laid a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknowns at Arlington National Cemetery, as is tradition. They went to church where the Reverend preached a sermon using the Obama campaign theme of forward, talking about the Israelites leaving Exodus, saying we have to move forward when forward is the only option.
And of course, this, as everyone keeps mentioning, would be the fourth oath.
Right. great,
that
making
the president
him
is
only the
in.
Second president in history to take the oath of office as president four times, the other, of course, being Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who won four terms in office.
Ari, I'd like to ask something, because you mentioned Sonia Sotomayor and refusing to go at a specified time because of the book signing. The book that Sonia Sotomayor put out reminds us that these political figures on stage, we see them as TV stars, we see them as celebrities, we may see them as awful, awful people if we disagree with their policies or their rulings on the Supreme Court. Some of them have really remarkable backstories.
That's right, and we have to give a shout-out here to a series of interviews Nina Totenberg, our colleague, did with Sonia Sotomayor about her life and the stories in this book. But I have to assume that is one reason that Vice President Biden wanted Justice Sotomayor to swear him in. Not only was she President Obama's first Supreme Court nominee, but she represents the story of having grown up in poverty, struggling with an alcoholic father and a mother who was absent for much of her childhood, and overcoming so much of that to attend Princeton and reach the highest levels of the judiciary.
So the first Hispanic Supreme Court justice will give the oath to the vice president of the first black president, if I'm getting that correct.
Yes, that's all.
And well, you guys are so excited about the first, but the truth is three other women have sworn in
presidents or vice presidents.
So perhaps in her favor, the fact is, what's remarkable here is that it's not so remarkable that a woman justice can be a part of this day.
Absolutely.
And Richard Blanco, the inaugural poet, the first Hispanic inaugural poet, although there haven't been very many, also the first gay inaugural poet. So pretty remarkable series of firsts there. We are continuing to listen to the U.S. Marine Band as some of the dignitaries and their families have begun to file in now. We'll be watching that over the next few minutes as we draw closer to the president's inaugural address. He will take a symbolic oath of office a little bit before noon today, repeating, one hopes, one assumes, what happened on Sunday. After that, he'll deliver an inaugural address. It's expected to be about 20 minutes long. And Ari Shapiro, what, if anything, is known about what he intends to say?
Well, he's going to talk about the fact that while there are divisions that we cannot overcome, we have an obligation as a country to come together and move ahead when we are able to do so, and the crises confront us that we have to solve. He's going to talk about our obligation to solve them. It's a message of unity, as every inaugural address must be, but it's also a message of unity that is realistically tied to the moment we're in of extreme divisiveness.
All right. Now, I want to bring in NPR's senior Washington editor, Ron Elving, along with Mara Elias and our national political correspondent, to pick up on that point that Ari Shapiro just made. Because, Ron and Mara, I'm remembering 4 years ago when Republicans did all the things that you naturally do on Inauguration Day. You say, well, it was a good speech the guy gave, and we wish him the very best, and we are coming together. We're not Republicans or Democrats. We're Americans. They said all those things. And then, of course, you dive right into the partisan ferocity of the last 4 years. Do we have any reason to expect that the surface of an event like this can actually affect the substance in the months and years to come?
The surface of an inaugural event, probably not. But I do think that things might have changed in Washington. Other things can change the dynamic. I think that Republicans are rethinking the best approach to President Obama. They're looking hard for a line in the sand that they can actually defend instead of trip over and cave like they did in the fiscal cliff. So I do think that things could be different, not necessarily because of what's said at an inaugural event, although that sets a tone and is an important national civic event. But I do think things could be different because the election was different. The election was important. It was decisive. And it had some pretty profound results, especially in terms of the Hispanic vote, that, for instance, I think makes it easier for the president to get comprehensive immigration reform.
We're going to be looking at members of the House of Representatives watching the president speak today. The president seems to have polling in his favor, at least at the moment. That could change at any time. It is presumed that gives him power, but it's also presumed that many Republican members of the House of Representatives don't have to worry about that because they have safe districts. They have districts that have been drawn for them. Are Republicans beginning to see it differently, that they feel that they do have to collaborate with this president on
something? Well, that's one of the biggest new dynamics in Washington, is that the House of Representatives almost lives in a parallel universe, a kind of universe that plays by different rules, where, as you said, the only thing that many Republican members of the House have to worry about is a primary challenge. They don't have to worry about a general election challenge because their seats are so safe because of redistricting. So even though they lost the national vote for the House, actually, more people voted for Democratic members of Congress than Republicans because of the way the population is distributed and compacted in the urban areas. So they don't have to compromise to hang on to their seats. On the other hand, polarization, while extremely advanced, is not completely perfect yet, and there are probably about 50, Ron can tell me the number, 30 to 50 Republicans in Pennsylvania or the Northeast, places where they do have to compromise. And also then there's the whole question of you can't govern the country from the House of Representatives. They have one-third of the government. So they're thinking through these things. They went on a retreat this weekend. They're trying to decide how much cooperation to give them and when to not kind of tilt at windmills. And they made that important decision with the debt ceiling this weekend. They're not going to make that a complete showdown event.
And, of course, while we have a moment, I just want to mention up on the stage here, we have some people filling in the VIP area. Yeah. Ari Shapiro spotted some folks.
Merle Evers Williams, who will be delivering the invocation a little bit later, and her daughter, Rena Evers Everett, both just took their seats. And you have to imagine what this must be for Merle, this 80-year-old woman who has, you know, first 50 years ago seen her husband assassinated.
And her husband, Medgar Evers, who was the NAACP field director at the time.
And now to be here delivering the invocation today, sitting there watching her face with this huge beaming smile, imagining what must be going through her head at this moment.
And I think I spotted the mayor of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel, on stage. You've got a few folks
former
like that.
Former chief of staff to President Obama at the start of his first term.
So that's on one end of the Capitol. We've got NPR's Sonari Glinton out there with a group of folks, just everyday folks coming in from Chicago, Illinois, and Missouri, St. Louis. Sonari, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. How are you doing, Audie?
So what's it like for your folks? Where are you guys headed?
Well, everyone here, I'm right between the, right next to the National Gallery, and everyone here is talking about what they want to hear from the speech, which is, the woman just told me she wants to see the president stand his ground on the assault weapons ban. That they say they're looking for the president to be stronger in the second term, and that's important for these people who have known him for a long time.
So already talking about agenda items that they're looking for.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, and also everyone talks about how this is their chance to see, that they didn't believe that they're going to see the first inauguration. And a woman just told me that the chance of seeing another black president in her lifetime is not going to happen. But being here to witness it was really important. And, I took an 18-hour train ride with a bunch of these people from Chicago, and then others took a 15-hour bus ride. All to come to be a part of this.
Okay, that's two people now who've told us that passed on word that they don't think they'll ever see another black president. We're going to keep a running tally throughout the morning.
That's what everyone's telling me.
Okay, maybe we should add a few more hash marks then for you. It's also interesting to hear you say that people want the president to stand his ground. This has been one of the great dilemmas for this president, has it not? Is that he is expected by his partisans to be tough, not to back down. He's accused by some liberals, in fact, of having been weak in many key negotiations. And yet large parts of his political base also expect the man to compromise. And in fact, it's been seen as an advantage for him in some polling that he was seen as more willing to compromise, but that means you can lose some battles. I wonder if people, those supporters of the president there, are prepared to be patient, prepared to see him give some, prepared to see him compromise when he has to.
Well, you know, everyone seems to say, like, this is the time. Like, the first term, like, he got a bye, but this is the time that they are, I mean, on the train ride, all the people I hear is that this is the administration that they expect to see real action during. So, they seem to have been patient. I mean, you know, as the woman said, she took a covered wagon to be here. They seem to be patient, but there is some urgency in the crowd here.
Audie, can I just borrow your binoculars there? I want to look out and see if I can see the covered wagon
right
out there. Maybe it's out by the Washington Monument somewhere.
Well, I think I am going to use them to say hi to Don Gagne in a bit. Sonari, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And NPR's Don Gagne is actually down at the Lincoln Memorial. Hi there,
I'm
Don.
I'm waving.
Technically,
you
can see you, Don.
Me.
Technically, yes.
Yes. So, Don, of course, the Lincoln Memorial, you know, it has inscriptions of Lincoln's second inaugural address in it. And what are you hearing from people as they kind of reflect on that president and reflect on this one?
There is so much rich symbolism at this place this morning on this day. It's Martin Luther King Day, of course, and a lot of people, again, the Lincoln Memorial isn't crowded. It just kind of looks like it looks like on, you know, any other weekend day in the city. But people have been coming, and they've been stopping at that engraving on the steps, marking the day in August of 1963 when Dr. King delivered his I Have a Dream speech. And a lot of them are coming here just to pay their respects before they head to the other end of the mall. And most of the people who've been coming here don't have tickets. They're just going to the non-ticketed area. They say they're going to get as close as they can get, but they wanted to stop here first.
Of course, there's a plaque commemorating the March on Washington, although the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial is a ways away, quite a walk away.
Yes, exactly. But you do have the engraving on the steps here, marking the spot of the speech. We've talked to people who remember that speech. One 75-year-old African-American woman from Omaha said, you know, she was just a young girl, and she remembered that speech on television, and she remembered the coverage of it. And she said, seeing that engraving today reminds her, as does the statue of Lincoln, kind of up behind it, reminds her that this country needs great leaders. And she certainly feels that President Obama is that.
And let me just remind people, we are on the west front of the Capitol where the president will be delivering his inaugural address at the end of the next hour, right around noon Eastern time. Don Gagne is, I think, about 3 miles away from us, but actually in view from the top of Capitol Hill here, not in view, but the Lincoln Memorial at which he's standing is in view. And most, but not all, of the space by any means between here and there is filled with people at this point. You were reflecting on different moments in history, Don Gagne, and I'd like to ask Audie Cornish to reflect a little bit as well as you're listening in, because Audie, you were at that memorial, that Lincoln Memorial, 4 years ago for the first inauguration of a black president. I'm curious how that moment felt then. What stands out for you after these 4 years?
I think what stood out for me most at that time was, A, the number of families, you know, people who were dragging pretty small kids out so early in the morning. And it was pretty crowded, even when it was still dark. There were people sitting on the lip of the reflecting pool. There were people who were talking about both the Lincoln Memorial and President Lincoln, and also the March on Washington. And I think that while President Obama at times has inserted language that alludes to Martin Luther King, maybe not saying the name, but he'll quote him and he'll imply it. And I think that a lot of he does it because so many people are doing it anyway. You know, it seems fairly obvious.
Yeah.
And you can hear it just, you know, as Don said, as Jeff mentioned to us earlier.
Don, this is a president you have followed from nearby and from afar. This is a man who speaks very carefully about race, is very aware of the symbolism of being the first black president, but does not rush to bring it up, and very, very much chooses his moments to talk about it.
He certainly does, and his staff will always say he is president of the entire country, and certainly he is. You know, the people I'm talking to today, a lot of them weren't able to make it here 4 years ago, but they wanted to be here for this one. A lot of them are saying that, yes, the barrier 4 years ago, and that was an important moment in U.S. history, but that this one may be even more important, that it's validation. As one woman said to me, it proves it wasn't a fluke. And, we won't hear the president talk about those things, but just the way he carries himself will in many ways be kind of the embodiment, I think, of what she's talking about there.
And let me just mention that more and more dignitaries are coming here to the front of the Capitol as people cheer. John Roberts, the Chief Justice, I believe I saw him. John Kerry, definitely recognizable. The Secretary of State designate, former presidential candidate. Other leading senators, I think that may be Carl Levin that we see there. Richard Shelby, perhaps, a variety of...
We are John Thune. We're also looking at John Barrasso, some of the people in the Republican leadership of the Senate. I don't know if we can bring in Ron Elving here. Ron, it's interesting seeing these particular folks file in, John Kyle, other lawmakers who may, you know, if they were... saw themselves as hopefully being an obstacle to this president in his first term.
They obviously have to have memories in their minds of the first 4 years. And when you think back to that first inaugural and the hope that there was going to be some sort of bipartisanship or some sort of meta-Americanism that was going to take over in those weeks and months ahead. I think it's fair to say that many of the Republican representatives and senators saw some possibility of that and were not entirely opposed to it. But what they started to encounter when they went back to their districts and states was that a lot of people, a lot of their constituents, a lot of the people who had voted for them were not on board for any of the Obama program, were not exactly lifted away by the inauguration spirit 4 years ago, and wanted their Republican representatives to resist. And that's when things started to toughen up, August.
And of course, we saw, you guys spoke about change earlier, but the fact is there isn't so much change, right? I mean, the Senate and the House are still in the same hands.
That's right. There are two more Democrats in the Senate than there were before, and there are eight more Democrats in the House. But that's out of 435. The Republicans still have clear control in the House, and they have signaled that they are planning to use it. They are planning to be as resistant to the president as they were in the last 2 years. So that's the reason why that sort of spirit of, if you will, meta-Americanism is a little bit less in evidence 4 years later.
And we continue to see senators move in. There's Richard Durbin of Illinois.
Bernie Sanders of Vermont.
And it is strange to note, Ron Elving, we've just got about 10 seconds. Is it unnatural for some of these politicians? We're watching them work the room here, in effect. They're people. That's how they got into this job. Is it unnatural for them, in a way, to refuse in the end to come to some accommodation?
Yes, it is. It's unnatural for them, most of them, because they like to make a deal. That's why they're in politics.
Okay, that's NPR Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving. We're going to continue our live coverage of the presidential inauguration on NPR News. And we continue our special coverage of Inauguration Day 2013 at the West Front of the United States Capitol. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Audie Cornish. It's the 57th presidential inauguration.
And we're live overlooking the National Mall here in Washington, D.C., where the president will take the public, we should stress, public oath of office in just a little over an hour.
NPR reporters Don Gagne and Elsa Chang are on the Mall, where up to 500,000 people are expected to watch the inauguration.
Nana Ulabi has talked with folks who will be along the parade route.
And Nina Totenberg will tell us how Justice Roberts plans to get the oath of office right this time.
And let's bring in NPR's Nina Totenberg to talk about that. She's our legal affairs correspondent. She's seen many an inauguration, and of course she has closely covered Chief Justice John Roberts, who, I don't know, it's probably going to be in his obituary, isn't it, Nina, along with whatever else he achieved in his life, that he once flubbed the oath of office.
Probably, but it really wasn't his fault entirely, except that he got flummoxed. He had sent to the White House, or to the President-elect's committee, through the usual channels, a card indicating where he would pause for the president to repeat each phrase. Trouble is, never got there. And so the president stepped on his words, and the Chief Justice had memorized the oath dutifully, because he's a great memorizer. But he'd never appeared before 2 million people before. And I think he just got flummoxed. And yesterday when they did it in private, the official oath in private, Obama, I thought rather graciously, said, I did it.
And Nina, I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about the relationship of President Obama to this court, because that is something that has definitely been a big change from 4 years ago.
Well, you know, this is a court that's still dominated by conservatives, and by and large, young conservatives. And they, in some ways, have his entire program in their hands. Chief Justice Roberts was the critical fifth vote to uphold what is now called, I guess, Obamacare, because the president has embraced it. But there are lots of other battles to come over the finance package, the financial regulation package, over wrinkles in the Obamacare package, over contraception, for example, over many things that will determine how the outcome of his presidency. So that it's an interesting phenomenon very often that presidents' agendas can be thrown off by the appointees of other presidents, and that's sort of the nature of the beast of the Supreme Court and life tenure.
Well, Nina Totenberg, I want to ask about another oath that's being delivered today. It's being administered by Sonia Sotomayor of the Supreme Court. You had some remarkable interviews, really jaw-dropping interviews with her as she put out a new book, a memoir, an autobiography, recounting her really remarkable childhood. And I say remarkable in that it was a very unhappy childhood. She spoke so frankly about it, and you think about how this person has come so far.
They were remarkable interviews, and I say that not because I did anything special, but because she did. And her book is that way. It is so self-revelatory and so, at the same time, introspective of what has happened in her life and how she proceeded in her life. And she's, of course, the first Hispanic to serve on the Supreme Court, and Vice President Biden specifically chose her to swear him in, and she did that yesterday. She's going to do it again today. The Latino vote was so critical in this election. It is, you can see that Latinos are so much more a part of this inauguration celebration than they were the last one or anyone. You know, the poet is a Latino poet, a Cuban American poet. There, Eva Longoria is on the committee. There are all kinds of ways you look around, and the accents in this. All the sort of if an inauguration is full of accents that sort of bring out the picture, there are a lot of Latino accents.
And in just a few seconds, Nina Totenberg, I'm curious, based on what you know of Sonia Sotomayor, a formality like this oath, is this something that is really memorable to her, really important to her, or something that she's a no-bones person and she'll do it because she's asked?
No, I think it must be pretty special to her. She grabs life by the throat and remembers every moment of it, I think. And she said at one point that if you let it overwhelm her, she wouldn't be able to do her job. But I'm sure she's just savoring the moment.
Okay, thanks very much. That's NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg.
And we're going to head out to the National Mall, where NPR reporter Elsa Chang is there. People have come from far and wide. A lot of people have traveled here. And Elsa, who are you speaking to?
I'm speaking to lots of folks here from Nashville, Tennessee, to the Far Rockaways in Queens, New York. And, you know, one thing that I'm hearing over and over again is how thankful everyone is about the weather and how much more energy they have this time as opposed to 2009. And because it is a slightly, you know, it's a smaller showing this time around than in 2009, so many people are saying that, wow, I'm so much closer than I was back in 2009. I'm actually standing on the grass now of the mall as opposed to 2009. Carmela Gaines, she's 38 from the Far Rockaway. She and her mom actually were stuck in their apartment without water or electricity for 2 weeks after Superstorm Sandy, but they never doubted that they would be here today. And they remembered when they were here in 2009, they couldn't even get to the mall. So I asked her how she even experienced inauguration back then. And here is what she said.
We didn't see anything. We came by Amtrak. We got off at Union Station. We're across the street from the Capitol, from the Blue Gate, but we had to listen to it on the radio because we couldn't get anywhere near.
Wait, you came all the way here from Queens, New York, and you listened to the inauguration
on the radio. Yes, we did.
And we're hearing a lot of that. People are just sort of kind of wondering at the fact that they can walk freely across the mall and that they're not hunched trying to keep warm during these hours. I asked Carmela and her mom also if they felt that this time around was historical. And, you know, what's interesting is you hear so many people today say, well, you know what? Who knows if this will ever happen again, another African-American president. This may
there
be the
go.
Last time we see an African-American president get inaugurated. So that's why it's historical today.
Also, we're up to three major mentions of that very same thought. So, yeah, we're going to ring a bell when we get up to five. Can you just tell Carmela, if you see her again in the crowd, she's still allowed to listen on the radio. It's not that bad. She's allowed to do that if she wants.
I sure will.
And can I just mention also, Elsa Chang, when we first arrived at this spot, when the sun was first coming up, there was quite a lot of grass visible on the National Mall. There is still some open space we know from hearing from NPR's Don Gagne at the Lincoln Memorial, but we can't see it anymore. What we see virtually all the way from here to the Washington Monument or the vicinity of the Washington Monument is people, with the exception of some corridors that have been left open for security. This may not be the crowd of 2009, but it is a crowd, and it sounds like it's exciting, at least for the people who are in it, to be there, Elsa Chang.
Sure is. In fact, when I was trying to get back here into the tent, I thought, oh, no problem. There's large patches of ground. I can get back here into the press tent pretty quickly. But I really had to squeeze my way through large clumps of people. It is definitely filling up a lot more quickly than I thought. When we were here around, you know, 8 a.m., I thought, gosh, is it even going to be half as many people this time around? But it does. It's festive. It's loud. And people are really, really raring to get a party going.
Elsa, thank you so much for speaking with us. Hearing you talk about this makes me want to talk to Pam Fessler, because she has been watching the transit and sort of logistics of the day. How you doing, Pam?
Hey, fine, Audie. How are you?
So last time around, it wasn't just the weather, frankly. People were scared of the amount of security, what they thought was going to be very difficult to manage transport. What's it like this time around?
Well, so far things seem to be going quite smoothly. As everybody said, the crowds, there's obviously a lot of people out there, but the crowds are nowhere near what they were in 2009. And I think that, you know, people around here are getting pretty used to the security. People are kind of know the drill. They know that they might have to wait in line at security checkpoints down by the mall. So for the most part, we've been getting reports that people have been in a fairly good mood. There was one checkpoint at not far from NPR here, actually, at D Street and 7th, that did not open when it was supposed to open, and people were waiting for about 90 minutes or so. Nobody can explain yet. The Secret Service will not explain yet why that was closed. But still, people were just told then to go down to a different security checkpoint. So for the most part, we have...
like the Purple Tunnel of Doom,
no Purple
right?
Tunnel of Doom.
We should update people on that story.
Right. That was when thousands of people with tickets, purple tickets, in 2009 never got into the cleared area, the security area, to see the inauguration because...
But they got a purple
stuck.
Ticket. What did they want?
They got a purple ticket. Well, the one thing we are hearing that some people with green tickets this year are getting inside the area, the viewing area, to watch the swearing-in, and they're finding that they actually can't see anything at all, and a few of them have reportedly left to see if they might get a better view out on the mall there with one of those big jumbotrons. Other than that, they really have, you know, things seem to be going fairly smoothly. There were a few protesters overnight here in D.C., they were anti-government protesters, and the D.C. police say that they were wearing masks, and they damaged some ATMs and a window of a restaurant here in Chinatown, but that was about it.
And we should talk about matters of scale, right? Because at 1.8 million, and that's an estimate from 2009, that was one of the biggest inaugurations crowds ever.
The 1.8 million.
Yeah.
Right. And, of course, you know, we also, besides the crowds of people, there are thousands and thousands of police and law enforcement officials in this city. Not only do we have the D.C. police, we have the Capitol Police, federal law enforcement authorities, and they also brought in 2,000 law enforcement authorities from around the country to help out today. There are also 6,000 National Guardsmen who are helping with security and other matters. So things are pretty much under control, at least so far.
Okay, thanks very much. That's NPR's Pam Fessler monitoring the crowds and monitoring security and transit today. Audie Cornish was pointing out earlier that we have all lived the last decade or more in the shadow of 9/11. Security has changed. There is no doubt that security is more intense in an event like this than it was in the past. It's been exceedingly difficult for some people to get where they want to go. And yet I think it's meaningful that the event goes on. The event proceeds. It is still very much the same scene.
And people are far more prepared. I didn't see a lot of big backpacks. I didn't see a lot of people hoping for the best, you know, bringing their sleeping bag. I mean, unfortunately, after 10 years, we all kind of know the drill.
People adjust. The president will be speaking about 100, 150 feet from us there, somewhere in that range. Behind, we should notice what would appear to be bulletproof glass, but nevertheless out in public. Let's go out now to NPR's Netta Ulaby, who is also working the crowd. Netta, who are you? Where are you?
Hey,
who are you also? And who have you been talking to?
Well, I am on a bus right now with 100 very excited high school students. They're from Dobbins Bennett High School in Kingsport, Tennessee. They're looking very smart in their scarlet and silver uniforms. There's a lot of sequins and feathers and brass instruments sticking out into the aisle. And I actually have a young lady here, a senior named Tyler Anderson, who, if you'd like to say hello to her.
Oh, yeah, sure. Put her on.
Hi.
Hey, how are you? Tell us about your trip
exactly.
So far.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Hi, it's Steven.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. I'm sorry.
Great. Tell us about your trip so far. How's it going?
It's been going great. We came in yesterday. We drove down. Took about 6 hours. Stopped at Town Alexandria to eat and walk around a little bit.
Okay, and we've started to lose the line, but it sounds like it was an exciting trip for her. I don't know if we still have Netta Ullaby at all at this point.
We just heard actually a big crowd cheering just now, and that's because the president, the motorcade, had begun moving. And we saw a big crowd start cheering and waving things from a distance. The president of the United States
A presidential drive-by.
Right.
We missed it from our vantage point, but the president is almost in the house, and we'll be giving the address shortly. Hopefully the folks on the bus with NPR's Netta Ullaby will be able to get in position to see something by the time that happens. NPR's David Wellner is with us next. And David, what have you been seeing?
Steve, members of President Obama's cabinet have just come in. They've been preceded by members of the House and Senate. And it's interesting watching how these members of Congress have arranged themselves. Normally, you have them segregating into Democratic and Republican cliques. Today, they're really mixing with each other. It's a day of fraternity. As I said before, kind of a ceasefire.
Time people talked about this actually was more than a year ago with the shooting of Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords. If you remember the State of the Union after, they were encouraged to sit side by side and not have partisan seating.
That's right. And I think today we're seeing a bit of that as well, despite all of the rancor that goes on the rest of the time around here. Today is a day of fellowship, I guess.
A couple of odd couples. At one point, though, I saw Senator John Tester of Montana and Claire McCaskill of Missouri taking iPhone pics together, two people who had pretty tough years election-wise.
Indeed. And I also saw the newly elected Democrat from Indiana, Joe Donnelly, to the Senate, moving over from the House, along with his colleague from Arizona.
Jeff Flake, incoming Republican from Arizona,
who also is moving over from the House. The two of them sort of venturing over towards the Senate side of the seating area.
Well, even though you do have people mixing in different ways, NPR's Ari Shapiro, these are people who were denouncing each other just a few months ago.
Yes. I should mention, up in the VIP group, we just saw the Supreme Court justices enter, some of them wearing different black hats of various styles, from Justice Kennedy with a beanie to Justice Scalia with what looks like a velvet three-pointed cap.
It looks like he's ready for graduation.
Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg was sort of being escorted by Justice Clarence Thomas. But what you're alluding to, Steve, is that many of these senators were not only opposing President Obama in the Senate, they were surrogates for Mitt Romney on the campaign trail. I can remember being at Romney campaign events in the last year and seeing John Thune speak, seeing John McCain speak. Those people are sitting here now ready to celebrate the inauguration of the president who they did not want to see reelected, but they're here to celebrate the
process. And let's go out to NPR's Linda Wertheimer, who's at the Canadian Embassy. Linda, what have you been seeing as people cheer here at the West Front of the Capitol?
We've seen the president coming to the Capitol. The motorcade passed just a few minutes ago with a lot of big, long limousines that are containing, I assume, members of the family and the presidential party, which has just arrived at the Capitol building. The president has been escorted inside. So we are getting, this thing is getting ready to happen. The president's motorcade, which was enormous, with these huge number of armored vehicles and all kinds of security. Of course, there's always a big hint. There's a camera crew that is driving right in front of the president, so you know which car he's in. And as he passed along, huge cheers from this crowd. The Pennsylvania Avenue crowd is still a little bit light because they're waiting, I suppose. They'll come out of the mall and crowd the avenues to see the parade itself.
And there are chairs waiting for the president and vice president once they arrive. We see John Roberts and Sonia Sotomayor, the Supreme Court justices, who will be administering oaths today. And
we also see the color guard, which is lined up directly across from us.
They are in place inside the Capitol now. The president will wait in the rotunda, and then they will come straight out. So it's over to you, Steve, for quite a while, I think.
Okay, thanks. NPR's Linda Wertheimer. We'll be hearing more from her later on today. There's a parade later on today, much more to see.
Just a few minutes, I believe the vice president's family will be seated. We see everyone up on the platform right now is standing, which leads us to believe that the vice president and the president's family should be coming out in a few minutes. The color guard is on the move.
on the move down below the podium, down below the lectern where the president will stand, the American flag coming in. Up on the lectern itself, all the seats are filled now, or virtually all the seats are filled. People watching expectantly to see who comes out next, waiting for the vice president to be followed by the president. You know, I can't help but wonder, looking at Roberts and Sonia Sotomayor, those don't look like the warmest robes I've ever seen. I mean, they haven't been outside as long as we've been out.
I see them donning gloves right now, though, so who knows?
They were barehanded at first, and I did wonder about that.
We also see some vanquished past presidential contenders. And John McCain is out in front, and Newt Gingrich is seated also with his wife, Calista.
And we will have that in a moment. First, we're going to take a brief break in our coverage, special coverage of the inauguration from NPR News.